ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. We generally bring on people from around the world and we have a good old-fashioned happy time. But today, I have something to say before I come to my very special guest, Martin Dutre, coming at us live from New Zealand. He's going to be talking about a little bit of ancient archaeology. But before I go to him, I've got just a little something to say about the New Zealand police. When I was shoved and kind of like physically kind of altercated with these people, you know what occurred to me? The day that I can hit them back if they assault me unlawfully is the day that I will feel free. Okay? Cop comes up to you, starts asking you for your ID and stuff like that. You haven't broken any laws. He's just sitting there with a video camera on the street, you know, filming a government building or whatever, doing a report live or anything of that nature. Cop comes up to you, starts asking for your ID. You're like, oh, you don't have any right to see my ID. Get out of here. And then he starts attacking you and bashing you over the head with a baton. That is the moment where I'll grab that baton off him and bash him in the head with it. Crack his skull! Cut off one of his ears and gouge out one of his eyes. And the day that I can do that, where he initiates violence against me and I defend myself and mess him up without his buddies coming and beating the living crap out of me and maybe killing me and saying it was a suicide in the cells or something directly afterwards, the day that I can do that and get away with it because I was doing what was right, defending myself against a criminal, tyrant, scumbag. The day I can do that is the day that I will feel like a free man again. Until then, if a brutal scum piece of trash can come up and just accost you, attack you, and force you to follow anything he says for any crap reason that he makes up, you're a slave. I will not be a slave anymore. Sick of it, man. Who do these people think they are? Who do they think they're dealing with? What do you think the kind of society is going to erupt if people tolerate this kind of behavior? If these people have no fear of repercussions of the average people? That was what it was on my mind this morning. And now, we're going to go on to something a little bit less grotesque. Martin Dutre, coming to us live from New Zealand. Martin, welcome to the program.
Yep. Good to see you.
Now, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, because the first time I saw you was at the Uncensored Conference a number of years ago, where you did a presentation about pre-Māori civilizations, plural. And there was an awful lot of artifacts and archaeological sites, finds, ancient walls, old stories from the Māori elders about these pre-civilizations and what have you. I edited it. Took me more than a year or something to actually get around to it. Sorry about that. But it's now got over 10,000 hits on my YouTube channel and is, in fact, one of the most highly commented upon videos that I've ever uploaded in my 5 years of exposing scumbaggery. So, congratulations for that. The problem is, the vast majority of those comments are from incredibly angry, brain-spasming individuals who pour forth demonization, anti-Semitic remarks, and white supremacy remarks against you. The insanity of telling the truth and the reaction from the public could never be more poignant than if you watch the Martin Dutre video, pre-Māori civilizations, in New Zealand at the Uncensored Conference. You can find that video on Mr. News Guerrilla Media. And I was wondering, Martin, what is it that compels you to expose this very, shall we say, controversial topic and to deal with all of this hiss and spite as a result? What gets you through?
Well, yeah, I was raised with that history. When I was very young, my mother, my grandparents, we all knew about the pre-Māori people in New Zealand. It was in all of our history books. Later, as I became a young carpenter, I worked in Māori communities, and I used to talk to the old elders, the old kuias, the kumatuas of the different iwi, and they were very open in discussing about the pre-Maori people, describing them as Urukehu and Kiripuwhero, that they had a very light complexion to their skin. They had predominantly red hair, but they're also described as having blue eyes, green eyes, all of the hues of European, you know, eye colours and skin complexion. So that was just open knowledge. But then I went overseas and I was travelling around for a number of years doing the big OE, and I came back to New Zealand. And this was about 1974 or so, and I could see that we were kind of being enveloped in a forced amnesia, that we were all of a sudden required to forget all of that history that was in our older history books. And this was a period of time when there was a lot of civil rights stuff going on in the United States, and it seemed like here in New Zealand there were various groups like the Polynesian Panther Party who absolutely adored anything going on with the black communities and that in the United States, and wanted to import all of those gripes, moans and groans, or all of that history of oppression and slavery. They wanted to sort of bring that into New Zealand and make it apply to the local population. And it was mainly amongst the Polynesians, and they seemed to adore all of the styles of the time, the great big sunglasses, the velvet scarves that the American Negress women used. And they seemed to want to import all the stuff more or less as a fashion statement. And Maori were very reluctant to get involved in the beginning, but slowly, slowly they got drawn into it. People like Don R. Waititi and people like Sid Jackson and Moana Jackson and different ones. And then they started going to places like Cuba, Communist China, Russia, even Libya for arms training to learn destabilization tactics. And they came back, and all of a sudden, our history got reinvented. Our old history books that gave accounts of the old pre-Maori people and the oral traditions, they were no longer considered, appropriate, and they were called ethnocentric or Eurocentric treatises on the subject, and slowly they got ripped out of the library shelves and replaced by a whole new sort of lot of Marxist-laced history books. So everything got reinvented between, about 1975, and in the years that followed. And, then you started hearing all these catch-call phrases like, it sounded like stuff straight out of the People's Voice newspaper, British imperialism and all this oppression type stuff. And our history got reinvented.
I've got to say this here. Censoring of history is amongst the most important thing to do if you are currently in control because of scumbaggery you committed back in the day.
New Zealand had quite a different history from the slave type history of the United States, and yet it was the desire of these organizations to impose upon New Zealand the same kind of history so they could talk about themselves as being oppressed or, people who had fallen victim to British imperialism and all this sort of stuff. So they brought in or introduced a whole new kind of gripe or grievance type of history. And in the course of doing so, everything got shelved, including all of the old Maori oral traditions about the people that were there before. They were no longer convenient. The full focus had to be on, the advent of Maori in New Zealand, and anything before was sort of irrelevant, and that slowly got swept under the rug. It's been really sad because New Zealand, the landscape of New Zealand is absolutely covered with artifacts and structures from those pre-Maori people, as well as the skeletons in our burial caves. Yeah.
Okay. Well, seeing as we're talking about Marxist and Leninist and whatnot, there's an old Lenin quote, I believe. Who benefits? If the history is suppressed and a new paradigm of grievance instead of we were all sweet as, we sold about 75% of our land to European settlers under fair trading conditions, and there were people here before us, and we understand that everything's all cool, and there's now massive social problems within the Maori community. There's police suppression, all that sort of thing sort of comes into it as a we've got a problem here, let's do something about it, as opposed to we've got a problem here, it's your fault, you do something about it.
Right, well, I believe in warts and all history. Whatever history was, whatever unfolded, you know, you deal with it. You don't bury it. You don't deny it. You know, you don't make it into a sort of a weapon of political expediency. All of this pre-Maori history was here. But it looks very much like if you go back to, say, the 1960s or so, New Zealand was an extremely rich country. We didn't have a very big population, but we had a lot of natural resources. And one of the things that protected us was the Treaty of Waitangi. And the treaty basically guaranteed absolute equality for all New Zealanders altogether. But the overseas interests seemed to want to get their fingers in the New Zealand pie. I mean, we owned as a public railways, electricity, telecommunications, shipping lines, you know, airlines. We had islands here that were virtually solid copper almost. And, you know, oil, we had everything here, lots of coal reserves. And we had a sort of a socialized system where this was owned by the public. But overseas interests wanted to get their sticky fingers on what we had in New Zealand, all of our resources. So they dreamt up ways and means to kind of break through, nullify the Treaty of Waitangi, and then, you know, also end up privatizing everything so that we lost all of our natural resources, and things just have gone in the last so many years. All of our state-owned enterprises have disappeared into the international community, and now are all owned by overseas corporations. And a part of the, you know, the weapon to get this was the bringing in Indigenous rights legislation. We had something called DUNDRIP, United Nations Rights for Indigenous People. And the UN and the big corporations have used that kind of legislation in many countries to kind of break up the power base of the populations, and then they can get a few corrupt leaders, so-called indigenous leaders, and work through them, and through them grab the resources, ultimately grab the resources of a country. So that's what's happened to New Zealand. We've lost everything.
Whoa. Are you saying along the same time frame as Maori lawyers and Maori elites were saying all of our stuff got stolen off us and we're going to then collect money from the government, which is everybody in the country, and we're going to keep it to ourselves, not even give it to our people? The whole country was being sold out at that exact same time to foreign interests in more or less the same manner as their grieving about happened ages ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, there seems to have been a worldwide dumbing down, a worldwide program of propaganda, which gets us all thinking along certain lines, gets us forgetting who we truly are, what our true, you know, individual powers are. And they seem to use these ploys in order to, take over huge sections of society and impose their will to a greater degree. And a part of it is the loss of our history. We begin to forget who we actually are. And, so that's what's happened in this country. Our history has been reinvented, our colonial history. Our Treaty of Waitangi has been reinvented since 1975 and the Treaty of Waitangi Act, 1975. And our old history, because New Zealand is a very old country that's been continuously occupied for at least the last 5,000 years or more. And all of that's been swept under the rug. It's all for political expediency, and it's all done by social engineers to achieve a particular end.
To what end?
Well, the end is, I guess, globalization, where we're controlled by one group overseas who kind of own all of our resources, who are just basically in control, a very manipulative group of individuals. Yeah.
Well, what about the Reserve Bank Act that happened here in New Zealand, the institution of the Red Shield controlled bank? And it's interesting, a friend of mine, Will Ryan's, actually been to the Reserve Bank building in Wellington, and behind the desk of the front reception is a giant Red Shield on the wall.
Uh-huh.
What is,
yeah, Rothschild Red Shield, yep.
Yeah. So you know, it's corporate ownership. I mean, if you walked into that the Bank of New Zealand and you saw Coca-Cola on the wall, you would say, okay, well, the Reserve Bank's owned by Coca-Cola. We walk in, we see a giant red shield. Okay, they're owned by the Rothschilds. Pretty straightforward, I would have thought. And this banking cartel is the main concern of me and many other people. However, it's part of an eclectic game to get people in fighting with each other and impoverish them. We'll be right back with Martin Dutre in just a few minutes. Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week from 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 till 7 Central, 4 till 6 Mountain Time, 3 till 5 Pacific, and I believe it's something around the region of 1 p.m. or till 3 p.m. in Hawaii, might be midday, something of that nature. In New Zealand, midday till 2 p.m., Tuesday through Saturday. And if you're Aussie, you know what's funny? I can figure out the U.S. time zones real easy, but when you're looking at Aussie, I can't. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Kind of like, how can people survive in the desert? Why do they have time zones anyway? My very special guest is Martin Dutre. And Martin, do you even have a website?
Do I have a website?
Yeah.
I've got a couple of websites. One is dedicated to archaeology. I would say it's probably one of the biggest in New Zealand, talking about the anomalies in the New Zealand landscape. But then I have a second website, which is more regionally political, that deals with our Treaty of Waitangi, which would be our equivalent, really, to like the American Constitution or whatever. But that's been under assault. Our Treaty of Waitangi has been under assault here for about 40 years. And basically, it's been 100% changed, just so that we've lost pretty much all of our rights. Yeah, so I have a website dedicated to that as well. Yep.
Okay, so it's just the two. What are they?
Yeah, just the two.
What's the names of them so people can go to them?
www.celticnz.co.nz. The other one is www.treatyofwaitangi.net.nz.
Okay, CelticNZ.co.nz and TreatyofWaitangi.net.nz are Martin's two websites. Yes. Now, have you written any books, Martin?
Yeah, I've written a couple of books. When I saw the erosion of New Zealand history all those years ago, I tried to write a book as a stopgap, you know, to try and remind New Zealanders of the fact that, hey, we have all this old history. It's in Maori oral traditions. It's in our caves. How come this has been, eradicated, swept under the carpet? So I wrote a book, and it represented my research up to about 1998. I got it out in the year 1999, 2000, that period of time. I've since added a huge amount to my knowledge over those years, and I wish I could rewrite the book now. And so what I do to help the book along is just to maintain a website where all of the latest discoveries and that are actually added into the website. Yep. And the other
this,
book...
That's the problem with... I was just saying, that's the problem with writing books or making movies, is that as soon as the book's finished or as soon as you've finished cutting together the movie, there's always these things that, that come out afterwards that you didn't know while in the process.
Yeah, I know several authors like that. They agonize over their writing for years and years and years. They're always trying to improve it to the extent that they never publish anything. Yeah, because once you publish, of course, then that's it. There's nothing more you can add. The beauty of websites, of course, is you can go in and change parts of them, add new knowledge as it comes to light. That's good. The websites are great. Yeah.
Well, particularly if you're coming across knowledge which, well, basically re-alters your worldview. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, these days I'm referred to as a revisionist, which is really quite funny because I still believe the history, the New Zealand history, that I learned as a child, the history that was in all of our history books. I've added to it. I found a lot of structures around the country, which have given me much greater insights into the original people who were here. But it's the academics, it's our historians, it's our archaeologists or social archaeologists, social historians, social academics, who are the ones who are the revisionists. They're the ones that have completely changed our history. Yet that's one of the little Marxist buzzwords that's brought in when, you know, when somebody's not keeping with the status quo or the reinvented status quo, they'll just call you a revisionist. Or you mentioned earlier on a lot of the comments you got, you know, with regards to the talk I gave that you recorded. I only talk about archaeology. I only talk about, like, New Zealand colonial history, that kind of thing. And yet I get called all sorts of names, white supremacist, Nazi, Holocaust denier, anti-Semitic. I don't know. I don't write about the Holocaust or that side of things, but you still get subjected to that kind of name-calling just simply because you have stepped out of line with the status quo. Yeah.
Well, it's the only defense that they have. It was something our mutual friend Jonathan Eisen explained to me once, is somebody using an ad hominem argument, hominem meaning the man and ad meaning against. So your argument then becomes against the man himself, not against the information that he's presenting. And in this way, you can get people to think that somebody who has all the umpteen information in the world to back up their case in a perfectly reasonable and rational format can instantly become incredible and nobody will listen to them. This is how an ad hominem attack works. It's the tactic of the ruling elite, whatever the ruling elite form is taken, whether they be an intellectual elite. I'm a doctor. I know everything. You're just a conspiracy theorist by telling me that these drugs are incredibly dangerous and cause people to commit suicide and kill their entire families in the middle of the night while they're having a dream. You're just a conspiracy theorist. Oh, well, thank you for demonizing me with that name that was come up with by Richard Milhouse Nixon in order to demonize Woodward and Bernstein, who later on proved that he was part of a conspiracy.
Mm.
If you have this this madness or how would you term it? Madness or brutal clinging to this tree of knowledge that you'd previously been living under, you know, like a monkey. You wonder, at what point do I just let go of this branch and fall to earth? Stop attacking the other monkeys and start learning things for myself. You know, some people have been accused of not paying their taxes in the United States, like Stephen Baldwin or something. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, not paying your taxes is against the law. You go, really? You ever seen that law that requires you to pay taxes? Well, it must exist. By that, I think you mean no. I haven't actually seen the law. By that, I mean, yes, I have in fact just blindly listened to an authority figure who told me the way things are, and I trusted him implicitly because I'm too lazy to do my own fracking research and back up my own arguments. It's a circular thing. You can't break out of it. Can you, Martin? You're still going to get demonized as a white supremacist and Nazi and Holocaust denier and all of that kind of stuff, no matter what you say. So why even address it at all? Why not just keep talking about the things that you're talking about to people who will listen, you know?
Challenge these people to debates? That's really all you can do is just live your truth. I don't sort of deal in tangibles. I'd go out on the landscape and I'd look at structures that you can subject to the five senses. You can measure them. You can take it along a theodolite. You can detect alignments. One of the favorite ones, that the types of structures that I like the best, are like solar observatories. Because you can go to a place where you can find a great big obelisk, or it could be a cairn heap of boulders that they put up into a great big pile. It'll be sitting on a hill or in a very strange place, and you can tell it's been plonked there. It didn't occur there naturally. And take a theodolite, do a few measurements, look around the horizon, especially to what's out towards the east or to the west, and pretty well figure out that it's going to work for, say, the summer solstice, or alternatively, the winter solstice, or it's going to work for the equinox. So then once you've got it figured out, you go back there at the time of the summer solstice or equinox, and you watch the sun either rise or set. And it'll come down on a very, very prominent, totally chosen object, a mountain or into a dip. It gives the ancient people a very, very precise fix on that particular day, an equinox day. And from that, the ancient people were able to keep their calendars 100% true, knowing exactly where every day in the year was and when to plant exactly, when to harvest the various crops at their particular time, when the bird migrations were going to start running, when whales are going to be passing the coast, or, you know, it was just a time fix. Everybody was into calendars and doing things according to the seasons, 100%.
And what do you make of... go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you find these solar observatories all over New Zealand. Wherever there was an ancient sizable community, they would go to great labour to set up a solar observatory in their community. And there are hundreds of them still functioning perfectly well.
So what kind of a population size, let's say these people who put up these sun observatory sites, really, how much of a population base would it take in order to build and maintain those kind of things in terms of settlements?
Yeah, there must have been a huge population here at some point. Like, for example, if you go just down into the Taranaki region, you've got a whole lot of big, what they call pars these days, just in one area, and the labour expended to build each one of them. The cubic yardages of material that's been moved in order to create all the plateaus and actually build them, the tunnel systems that run through them, the labyrinths of tunnels underneath, huge labour has gone into it. And just in that one area around Korupa, there are about another six huge structures. And that's an indication of what you find all over New Zealand. And I think somebody's done an estimate that we might have as many as 10,000 of those structures. But not only that, we've got great big water systems where people have dug canals, big drainage systems that extend for miles. We've got mounds and all sorts of other structures across the landscape. And if you take the population model that's put forth by our academics, that 200 Maori arrived here in the year 1300 or 1350 or so, and in their group were 50 women, and from those 50 women came the entire population that was encountered by James Cook. How did such a small population create those huge structures? It's absolutely impossible that they could have done all of that work with so few people. So there's a previous population here, and they built hill forts in exactly the same style as you'd find throughout Great Britain, or going over to areas like Sweden and Scandinavia into continental Europe. They built in the same way, somewhere way, way back. These are now known today as Maori pas, but they were built by a much earlier group. And they're here in their thousands across our countryside. So what happened to now, them, I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I presume you're aware of Jonathan Gray, also an archaeologist, and he's written a book called Dead Men's Secrets. He lists about 20 technologies that the ancients had that were just as good or even better than technology that we've got today. Do you think that there might be any such advanced technology employed to build all these structures and things? Because, people using stone picks and shovels to create an incredible irrigation system, I mean, it seems kind of like a hell of a lot of work to me.
Yeah, a huge amount of work was done in this country. Even the putting up some of these the massive obelisks that weigh 70 ton or whatever they weigh, they've been hauled to the top of a hill and plonked on the tops of hills and things like this. You get all of the expressions in the New Zealand landscape that you'd have in, say, Ireland or, Scotland, Wales, England, continental Europe. You've got all those sort of megalithic-type structures, many beehive houses, which are now just collapsed piles of stone. And I've got a lot of pictures. I could show you pictures of a lot of these sorts of things if you want to see them. They're all over the country. Now, with regards to technology, I'm not 100% sure what technology they had, but certainly with their standing stone circles, they were encoding their sciences into the landscape in the same way that they did throughout continental Europe and throughout Britain. So standing stone circles were basically libraries of mathematical codes, which allowed them to remember the equatorial size of the Earth, the 18.6 year lunar nutation cycle, and everything they needed for their calendar systems.
All right. Now, Martin Dutre is my very special guest. CelticNZ.co.nz, TreatyofWaitangi.net.nz are his websites, and we'll be right back at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise,
welcome back.
Black sunrise, always gonna be.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, New Zealand's number one conspiracy talk radio show. 5 days a week, 2 hours a day. You can donate at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com or subscribe for $5 a month if you want to keep a support train a-truggin' for this particular broadcast and all of the other work that I do going out to public meetings and things of that nature, filming people who otherwise would get relatively well ignored by the mainstream media. My very special guest is one of these people who kind of gets either ignored or demonized by the mainstream media, unfairly, of course. His name's Martin Dutre, and he's got some pictures to show us here today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm recording the webcam shots on here, so those of you on the live stream, I'll have to kind of explain picture by picture as we go through what we're kind of looking at. So, Martin, if you would explain what we're looking at for this first picture here. Is a dude with a little tripod lining up something, little cluster of rocks in front of him, and a nice, beautiful New Zealand farmland scene behind him. What are we really looking at?
Right, we kind of ended up there. And this is a picture taken at a Mangarui Bluff. a beautiful valley called Duggable, right on the side. And what it is, they had a great big school of learning there where they were obviously teaching people all of the principles of navigation and solar work, all of the calendar systems, pretty much all the same information that they would have at the great schools of learning of Britain and continental Europe, places like Avery Henge or Broadgarden Ring, or even at the Cahokia Mounds in North America. So I'm at a what was formerly a standing stone circle. The component stones of it were drawn in by a farmer back in the 1960s, but he could never move the center stone, so I was able to actually get a good fix from there. Well, you take a fix onto a tor mound, which is up on the local hill. Now, a tor mound is like a pimple that's been very laboriously built. I'll see if I can bring that picture up. Anyway, this shows the tor mound pimple on the local hill. Now, the sun, did you get that picture? Has that come up, Vinny?
Yeah. Well, what we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen, is a decent-sized hill that kind of stretches from one side of the camera to the other. And right above the top of the hill, there's a sort of a very noticeable mound directly next to where the sun is about to set.
Well, that's actually the sunrise, and this is the day of summer solstice. And so from that field, standing stone circle, from the hubstone of that, it was set up so that the ancient people could get a very, very accurate fix on the summer solstice. And it would rise there at the edge of the tor mound, which has been laboriously built. It's a huge mound when you get up to it. And it is a marker for the summer solstice. And I can show you several others. Here, for example, go to this picture. I don't know if you can see this one yet.
The sun and a little line coming down to the mound here.
Right. Well, this is actually here in Auckland Isthmus. And you go to Stockade Hill in Howick, where when they built the redoubt there back in the 1800s, they had to move stones on the top of the hill in order to build the military redoubt. And you look from that position directly for 5 miles over there to the west, and you see a notch in the top of Mount Wellington. And on the day of the equinox, of course you can do this 2 times a year because you've got your vernal equinox and you've got your autumn equinox, the sun will come down and land in the trench. It won't do it on any other day of the year. It does it on that day. So from Stockade Hill, the ancient Patupoiarahe people were getting a perfect fix on the day of the equinox, and they could do that 2 times a year. And I've just put up another picture. And
So on the left we have a guy with Scottish bagpipes looking at the sun, and on the right we have the sun nestling down in a little crevice of the mountain there.
Right. This was another trick that they did several times. It's like returning fire to the volcano. Mount Wellington, which was called the Sighting Mountain, and it's very, very important because a lot of the overland alignments for the Auckland Isthmus originate on Mount Wellington. Very, very important place. But the ancient Patupoiarahe returned the sun, if you like, into the crater of Mount Wellington at the time of the equinox with this marking. We brought in a Scottish piper, Brian Mitchell, and he piped the sun down that day back into the cone. So the other picture beside it shows the sun hitting the trench. You might be able to see just a little indentation of the trench 5 miles away from our position on Stockade Hill, and it marks perfectly the day of the equinox.
Now, the why is it that these particular phases through the movement of the sun was so important to ancient peoples? Was it a way that they governed their lives in harmony with the earth, kind of thing? Like, this is when you grow your crops, this is when you harvest them, this is when you bow down and pray that it doesn't rain and go into a drought or something?
Well, absolutely. The sun was the giver of life, and of course the Egyptians venerated Ra, who was basically, you know, the sun god. They had sun gods, for the Greeks, Helios, and everybody worshipped the sun before the advent of Christianity. The sun was the giver of life, and all throughout New Zealand there's many, many solar observatories. I'm showing you another one right now.
Actually, Mount Wellington on the left there, is that right?
That's right, but we're no longer at Stockade Hill. We're now way over at Mount Albert. So we've moved 11 miles across the city, and we're at the top of Mount Albert where there's an ancient stone still sitting there. It's been there all the way through the colonial era. And on the day of the equinox, you can go to that stone and you'll see the sun rise on that same trench. So in other words, there was an alignment that ran through Auckland based on the equinox that went from Stockade Hill in Howick through Mount Wellington's trench to the stone on Mount Albert. And
there's three mountains. So there's three mountains perfectly aligned by which you can see the sun perfectly nestling during equinoxes and solstices.
Not solstices,
just equinox.
So you get both rise and set. You'll get the setting from Stockade Hill, and you get the rise when you're looking at Mount Wellington from Mount Albert. So it's beautifully done. It's an amazing piece of surveying, an amazing piece of, setting up of an astronomical observatory. And there are many of these around New Zealand. Here's another good one
that
might take a second to come up.
Yeah, I've got it. So we've got a man. Is that you, Martin, holding the camera on top of the little mound?
It's a friend of mine, Barry, and he's basically a druid, and he follows me around to different of the sites. He's very, very fascinated by what he sees, and he's visited many sites. And in this case, he's at a place where there was an ancient Patupai Arehe village, and it's at Te Papakanga Park out towards Riri Point, on the way to Thames. And here they had two beautiful big amphitheatres. The ancient people used to build a lot of amphitheatres where they would gather and they would seemingly have concerts or oratory or whatever it was, but they were right into big gatherings and, according to Maori oral traditions, singing very loudly and gathering together. But Barry's standing on a purpose-built mound, and on the day of the winter solstice, you look up to an area where there's a trench, a special trench on a local hill, and that's exactly where the sun will rise on the day of the winter solstice. But you can go up into that same trench, so I can find a picture of it. Can't seem to see one right here. I'll show you another one, though.
Oh, yeah, I see that. Well, we've got like a forest kind of thing. And what's interesting is there seem to be these ridges in the land as it kind of goes up to the forest. And off in the distance, there's a mountain with a very noticeable kind of circular jut taken out of it, almost right at the very peak there.
Right. Well, what it is, you're at Te Papakanga Park. You stand, that picture is very magnified, highly magnified, and it's taken from that mound. And you stand on that mound on the day of the equinox. Now, remember, before we talked about the winter solstice rise, so there's a fix from that mound for the winter solstice. But now we're talking about the equinox, and you stand on the mound, and on the day of the equinox, the sun will rise on that very, very prominent geological feature over on the Coromandel Ranges. So they got a perfect fix from Papakanga Park, from their mound, their purpose-built mound, on the both the and the winter solstice. Sunrise.
All right. Well, Martin, we're coming to break here. So after the break, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to cycle through a few more images. And I apologize for those of you who are listening live on the radio. I'm trying to describe it as best we can, but this will all be up on the YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media, so you can watch it. It's very, very similar to a TV show format now, I believe. Martin Dutray is my very special guest from CelticNZ.co.nz. And treatyofwaitangi.net.nz if you'd like to check out more of his work. And we'll be right back in just a few more minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Don't go anywhere. It is now hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. My very special guest, Martin Dutray from CelticNZ.co.nz and treatyofwaitangi.net.nz. Also wanted to remind listeners that I'm having a little bit of a financial crisis at home. So if you want me to keep on the air and do all this stuff for you, so you've got something other than mainstream news media crapola to listen to, it does cost just to survive, you know, just food and internet bills, rent, you know, the gas, the normal stuff that you'd need, essentially, just to run a very, very small home business. Not a lot of money, and I do try to make sure that we're producing content pretty much on a daily basis for you, usually several hours worth. We upload the videos and footage of protests in HD as a Creative Commons. So if you want to make a documentary or your own little YouTube video or whatever, you can download any of my videos, any of my interviews you want for free. Don't even bother asking me. Just do it and make your own little videos and your own little documentaries, and you can start contributing too. This is the tool and the platform that I'm trying to make for everybody to be able to use. And this will include this presentation today with Martin Dutray. Welcome back, sir.
Yeah, we're here.
Now, we are looking at a wee picture here of a person with very long hair standing on top of a very rounded boulder that's kind of inset into the land with a little tripod and a camera. What's she pointing the camera at?
Yep, this is another solar observatory. It's at Waiwera, and it almost got completely eradicated when they put through the new motorway leading up to that big tunnel, you know, as you go north from there. The ancient people needed a marker, so they went down into the kind of the Papas wetlands further down, which would have been rich in sand and lime, and extracted the big concretion boulders that were down there, then dragged them way up to the top of a clay hill. Now, these concretion boulders have definitely been moved to that spot because they cannot actually form in that environment. They need a particular kind of incubation environment in order to grow. They'll grow over a period of maybe 4 or 5 million years, but they've got to be in a kind of a sea type of environment where all the conditions are right for them to actually grow like a pearl. So when we find them in a situ like this on a washed clay hill, we know that they've been hauled there. Anyway, the ancient people very often in New Zealand used the great big round concretion boulders, just like they did around the Dikis Delta of Costa Rica. They seem to have a real veneration for these kinds of boulders. But the young lady in question here is my daughter, and some years ago she had a project, and so I took her out and about on the landscape, and we did another equinox shot there at Waiwera. And what it is, you're at the concretion boulders markers, and then you look directly east. And I hope that your pictures come up on the screen. And what are you seeing there, Vinny?
So, well, just a nice, beautiful New Zealand misty picture of the hills with an indent perfectly in the middle of where the two hills line up.
Right. You've got a hill in the foreground and a hill in the background, and where the two come together, they form a V. The ancient Patu Paiarahe used to exploit this kind of surveying situation very, very often throughout New Zealand, always using the landscape in this regard. Now, in this particular case, they plonked the big concretion boulders right where they did, so that you're looking absolutely due east into the middle of that V, like that gun sight. And that is where the sun rises on the day of the equinox. So it's another solar observatory. But this particular observatory was very, very clever in that you can come back in the evening, and over on the western side, there was a bit of a range, and it had a lovely V in it as well. And did you get this new picture?
Yeah, is that where is that the sun rising or the sun setting in that new picture? Because you can see the landscape itself just kind of brightened up in a sort of shadow by the light coming behind it. And you can see this perfect little V in the mark of the hill where the sun's coming in.
Right. Well, it's actually where the sun set. In fact, I'll give you the picture of the sun setting in the V from the concretion boulder. Markers, and the sun sets beautifully in the V only on the day of the equinox. So again, the local community, all those people living around beautiful Waiwera, anciently, this was their solar observatory for that community, or one of them. Yeah.
What happened to all of these people?
Well, according to Maori oral traditions, Maori talk about having come to New Zealand and how for quite a considerable period of time, it says Maori had to live in sufferance under the mana of the Patu Paiarahe. In other words, they had to mind their P's and Q's for quite a long period of time until they built up their own numbers. And then they whacked the people. They turned on them and cannibalized the ancient people. And we have many, many references to the ancient Patu Paiarahe being hunted down by the Maori tribes, and every iwi in New Zealand has oral traditions about this, about where the Patu Paiarahe used to live, what hills they were in, and about the period of time when they were hunted and cannibalized.
Well, what gave the Patu Paiarahe such power as to have the Maori want to live under them for so long without rising up?
Well, when Maori first arrived, they were in very small numbers, whereas according to the oral traditions, the people here before them were like ants upon the land. They were everywhere. There were a lot of people. So obviously when your particular group are very small and the resident population is very large, there's a period where you've got to kind of, you know, fit in and mind your P's and Q's, you know, and that's what they did for a very long period of time, until their numbers were sufficiently large where they could turn upon the other people and conquer them, which is what they did in every area.
In every area? So this was a nationwide Māori uprising. Were the Māori slaves to the Patu Paiarahe?
Were they what? Were they
slaves?
No, they weren't. No, they weren't slaves. We have nothing like that. I've talked to a few people who are of the Ngāti Hautū or the Patu Paiarahe lineage, and I'll just show you one of these people who has been campaigning for a very, very long period of time trying to get recognition for her people. And this was Monica. Can you see the picture there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Standing in front of a beautiful Māori house and all the designs and everything around her. She's got blonde hair.
That's right. Now, she is Ngāti Hautū. And the Ngāti Hautū were one of the last surviving Hautū Paihei tribes, one of the last Utu Kehu Kiripu fellow people. I knew many of these people when I was growing up. There were a lot of them in New Zealand. We used to call them waka blondes, whatever. And I used to work with a lot of them. I was a young carpenter. And I was around a smoker table, and they'd say, well, yes, I am Maori. I'm not of that Asian lineage. I'm of a different group. And some of the Maori boys in the table said, yeah, we used to go up and eat those fellas. And they're all very amiable, radical ball about it at that point, but that's really what happened to them. And the lady here, Monica, she has been campaigning for years and years for recognition of her people. And because they're a conquered people, they were conquered by Tupare Toa, they have no rights. They lost all of their land, they lost everything. And they just can't be recognized. So essentially, they are people who are not allowed to be remembered. And yet they're all over New Zealand. And incidentally, the type of building that is behind her, which we today would call a Maori whare or meeting house, all of this sort of stuff came into Maoridom from the Patupai Arahei people. People say to me, if there were people here before the Maori, where's your evidence? Well, the evidence is in Maori culture. That's where it is. Yeah.
What kind of practices or trades? Are there any languages that are passed down, construction techniques, things of that nature?
Yeah, it's looking like, we know that the Patupai Arahei in New Zealand were once distributed throughout all of the islands of the Pacific. And they spoke a particular language. You can look at a lot of similarities in the Polynesian languages. And it would seem that the Maori language really is related to the Patupai Arahei languages. During that period where they lived in sufferance, if you like, the ancient languages were passed down. So you've got a huge amount of Maori languages. Indo-Aryan, it has Indo-Aryan roots. It's Numidian Libyan, which is sort of like it's from the Egyptian or Berber kind of region. There's quite a lot of Basque-type words in there. It's a real mix, and, it's a mixture of Mediterranean languages all put together. So there's quite a lot of Hebrew. There was one professor who came out to New Zealand a few years ago, and I sent him a lot of excerpts of the most ancient Maori I could find, and he went through it and checked it, and you've got the situation happens in language where your softer sounds will disappear, but your more guttural sounds will stay on. And by doing a little bit of
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, we just had to quickly reconnect there. We had a little bit of a problem with Martin's audio. Hopefully he'll be picking up the phone soon. Now, we were talking about how these sort of language things carry through, you know, like there's these deep tones in the voice. And my brother, he lives in Tahiti. And in Tahiti, they have a language that's what they call, you know, the local people's language of Tahiti. And it's almost on a par, so to speak, with the Māori language. And you see these kind of things all over the place. You know, if anybody has a look into the English language and then you start trying to learn German French, Latin, any of these other European dialects, you'll find that there's an awful lot of words and things that are virtually the same, have the same meaning, the same sounds, or things of that nature. And I presume that it's not entirely dissimilar with languages from other areas of the world. Yes, Martin?
There's an individual, like I stated, from American University who came out here, and I sent him a lot of examples of the most ancient Maori I could find, and he detected that a very high percentage of it was actually Hebrew. He was an expert on German languages, and there's a huge amount of Hebrews come into the German language at a very, very ancient date. And, he detected that a lot of Maori has Hebrew in it. You also get stories where the Maori battalion during the Second World War were established in the Middle East. And, of course, all of the soldiers of all of the nationalities were always lacking in food. They wanted tea, they wanted dates or anything they could get their hands on. So there was a lot of bartering went on. And according to what I've heard from several sources, the Maori battalion boys were very successful in dealing with the Berbers, or the nomadic Bedouins, at least, because whole aspects of their Maori language were understandable to the Bedouins, and so they could actually ask for things or make themselves understood using Maori with those people. And so they were able to do very, very well in their trading. Yeah. But also, a lot of the so-called Maori gods and that, the tiki, the little squat god with the great big head and the big googly eyes and the tongue poking out and the round tummy and the patu across the tummy and the bandy legs and genitalia showing and all that. If you showed one of those statuettes to somebody up there in around Egypt, they say, "Oh, that's the little god Bess." So it's a god, the god for pregnant women, mothers and children. The little god Bess, he was the entertainer god up in that region. He later got distributed throughout the Mediterranean. The Romans had their form of Bess all the way to Scandinavia, and has obviously made it down to New Zealand. So when you see the portals at the gates of the Maori villages, you've got one of the gods represented there. Is the little god Bess. And I can show you examples of that.
No culture seems to exist in isolation. That's something I've learned about looking around ancient history or even current history. Even tribes that have been locked away for hundreds of years, like in Papua New Guinea and things like that, they share commonalities with other tribes in other areas of the world that for which they couldn't have had contact with, you know? We're all together in a way, and yet we're all uniquely separate and allegedly free. But we're not free, not anymore. And I think some people have got the idea that if you can make people forget that we're all really together and we're all really one and we share common ancestry and all of that kind of stuff, and hey, there's no reason to fight, there's no reason to kill and eat each other or anything like that, suddenly they get really ticked off. It's like, hey, man, what are you saying? We shouldn't be killing and destroying everybody's culture and putting ourselves on the top. That's just madness. We'll be right back. Martin Dutre.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, "Listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere."
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. This is the Patu Paiarahe Surveyor theme song. They used to, you know, sing it in chain gangs when they were putting up little bullhorns and things like that into the landscape. I've been everywhere, man, setting up surveying sites over there, man, watching the equinox and sunset, man. Oh, yeah, I've been everywhere. My very special guest is Martin Dutray. And we've just taken a bunch of screenshots that we have here. So we have the golden statuette of the god Bes. And he looks like a little pudgy guy with his legs bent and big ears and a little kind of like a little hat kind of thing. Something that you could put a bear on with his... man junk all hanging out in the front sort of thing. And it looks remarkably similar to a plastic tiki that are carved by hobbits in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's the little god Bes, yep, of Egypt. Yeah, he has all of the same attributes, really, of the little tiki or... Longo type god that you find at the ancient sort of portals of gates or the portals of doors for the pataka houses or the whole pas, you know. So what it is, he was the protector of mothers and, you know, pregnant women. You'd find depictions of the little god Bes on all of the birth houses of Egypt. Women would wear a green stone amulet around their neck in the shape of Bes, just like they, you know, Maori did later. They had, you know, the tiki would go around their neck. But the god, this protector god, he would play and he would dance for the children. And according to the, you know, the legend, if anybody came to the family with malevolent intent, the little god Bes would get himself between the children and this individual. And if they showed any threatening moves, the little god would spring up and tear their throat out. So he could be really vicious as well. And he was a protector of the family. So the ancient people, the Patu Paiarahe, brought all of this kind of stuff with them when they came down to New Zealand. They also brought the god Taranis or Taranak, who became Taranaki. And... he was the god of thunder and lightning and fire. But the little god Bes would dance for the children. So he was the vicarious representative, or at least the Maori warriors later who learned the haka off the Patu Paiarahe. They became the vicarious representatives of Bes. And it looks very, very likely that the haka started off as a protection dance for the women and the children, and it was like a line dance. And the men would get out and they would form their line, they would do the haka, but they'd start off down on the knee. And throughout the dance, they would maintain that squatted kind of look with the bandy legs, just like Bes, stomping their feet and looking quite, well, in many respects, comical, humorous, ridiculous in some respects. And the women and the children in the tribe could look at their menfolk and know that they were the vicarious representatives of Bes with the googly eyes and the flashing tongue. And they knew from that they would always be protected. So I believe it was a dance of protection originally, which later, when it was adopted by Maori from the Tirihu, who taught them these dances, it became a very aggressive war dance.
The stance of Bes, I'm looking at this other picture that you sent me where we have four little statuettes of Bes lined up, and they three out of the four have the hands on the top of on the top of the thighs kind of thing, or is that on his hips?
Yeah, he had the hands on the thighs, and then also Bes was very often shown holding a weapon. The weapon was the Egyptian Sa symbol, which does feature in one of the pictures I sent across, and it's shaped very much like a patu. And on certain of the wall murals of Egypt, you see not only the Sar symbol, which looks like a club or a patu, but you also see the regular patu. It shows up in the Egyptian wall depictions. And anyway, the Sar symbol, which is shaped like a club, means protection. That is what its hieroglyphic meaning is. And when you see the little god, the little Rongo god or Tiki god at the portal of the gates with a patu on the chest, really, if that was in Egypt, it would be considered that it was a hieroglyph for protection. That's what it would mean over there.
So I'm looking at this picture now. We've got what looks like three patus in the picture with another ancient Egyptian sort of hieroglyph, and also a Maori sort of carved gateway with these red wood. And all of these little statuettes that are positioned around the gateway are holding this green patu to their chest. This is the one you're talking about, eh?
Right. Just like they would have sort of depicted Bes in Egypt. Now, the thing is, you've got the Sar symbol on the one end, and then you've got a picture of Ramesses, and he's about to dispense of his enemies. But if you look to the side of Ramesses II, there's the Sar symbol on the wall and also the patu. Then you look at the Maori patu, which was absolutely identical in style to one that was created and used in Peru, even down to the fact that you have three notches right down there by the handle end, exactly the same. And, yes, and then this did come up on the gates very often. But the ancient Patupaiarehe villages were all taken over by the Maori conquerors, who then
What does the word patu mean? I mean, patu paiarehe, is there some kind of meaning there associated with it?
Yes, it's certainly not the name they called themselves, just like the ancient people of Britain, and that didn't call themselves pagans, or even the Picts. They didn't call themselves Picts. The Romans called them Pictus, so these are sort of derogatory terms. And patu paiarehe, according to a kamatua of Ngāti Kuri that I've spoken with, it means the people that you hunt and eat, patu meaning club. Patu paiarehe, that's his interpretation of what it actually means. Maori had many names for these people, so one of the names they had for them was, it means bastard, the tribe of bastards, in Maori, yeah.
Well, that's very pleasant.
Yeah, because these were considered to be enemies, yeah.
Why were they enemies? Why the revolt?
Well, I'm not terribly sure. It would seem that the individuals, the earlier individuals, were very, very peaceable. From Maori oral traditions, Maori, like, for example, the Arawa and different groups would arrive in areas like Rotorua, and they were all over the Patu Paiarehe people were all over Mount Nongataha. And Maori set fire to the fern and the bush there and basically burnt them out. And the Patu Paiarehe just left the area and headed north. They would seemingly mostly just move on rather than stand and fight. They were very, very peaceable. It would seem that very early on in the early history of New Zealand, when they first arrived, that they must have come from areas where there was a lot of war going on, because they built so many sort of hill fort type fortifications and defensive enclosures. But then it seems that they went for a very long period of time with no warfare and lost the art of warfare, and basically, they became easy meat for the warriors. Yeah.
Well, that's part of the human condition, isn't it? If you go into an area and you see other people there, like rabbits, absolutely defenseless, you could just cleanse them and take the land back.
Yeah, you take what you want. Yeah, that's the whole idea of sort of conquest, you only own something as long as you're strong enough to defend it. That seems to have been the way it existed between the Maori tribes. You know, people occupied certain areas, very nice estuaries or arable lands, but another tribe would come along and look at it and say, yep, we'll take that. And if they were strong enough, they could come in and take it by force. And that's pretty much the condition that everybody found when they, you know, came here in the early part of the 19th century or before. Maori, of course, were fighting amongst each other and, you know, they would take things by conquest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But own it by conquest, occupation, and the ability to defend it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were Maori sufficiently skilled at combat to defend their land against, say, English settlers who had muskets and whatnot?
No, I don't think they would have been ultimately. Certainly when the incoming settlers were in very, very small numbers, they could have been decimated very, very quickly. But, yeah, the musket was, you know, Hongi Hika, for example. He went to Australia. He did all that he could to entice Samuel Marsden and others to come to New Zealand, offering them safe haven, knowing full well that once the ships started arriving that he could then acquire muskets, and then he could go later when he had sufficient muskets on his raids of Utu, because he had a lot of revenge to deal out, especially to Te Raroa and Ngāti Whātua, but also to other groups around the country. So between, you know, 1814 through that period, he acquired a whole lot of muskets, and I think he unleashed the musket wars around about 1818. And then he just, after that time, with a little interim visit to England in between, he just caused major devastation down the country because he had so many muskets he'd acquired. Certainly in the early days, Maori could have definitely dealt to the incoming settlers, but offered them protection. And it was only much, much later that, you know, the British, the colonials, gained enough strength where they could defend themselves. But all the way through the actual, what they call colonial wars, which they call land wars these days, but they're actually sovereignty wars. Every time the British troops went out to deal to the King Movement or the Hauhaus or whatever, they always had other Maori tribes fighting alongside them as allies.
Well, and indeed, at the time, I became aware that British soldiers really feared assaulting Māori pās due to their tendency to be ambushed in guerrilla-style attacks and things like that. They're very, very cunning. They basically pioneered, to my knowledge, two types of modern warfare, guerrilla warfare and trench warfare.
Well, that's actually a myth that was dreamt up by James Belich. It's absolute rubbish. Trench warfare has been going on for thousands of years, and also has guerrilla warfare. That's just Marxist pseudo history dreamt up by the pseudo historians that have sort of come on the scene since the middle 70s. Okay. Maori found very, very quickly that they didn't want to confront the British colonial troops in open fields, in open hand-to-hand combat. during the, what do we call the wars, the New Zealand wars, Maori would go into pās and get themselves hidden down in trenches and would fire, you know, from closed parapets and from hidden positions, and left the British in every case to have to make a front-on assault at great cost to the British troops. That's the way they fought. And they did do a lot of guerrilla warfare, but when Hone Heke did his rebellion in the north in 1845, the small group of militia that went up to fight him was supported by Tamati Wakanene and his brother Matuoni and Moki Tafai, and they're the ones that saved the colony. Those Maori tribes saved the colony because they went in, and they are the ones that really actually dealt very severely to Honeheke and won the war, won the battle. They would engage in the same guerrilla warfare as Honi did.
Eye against eye. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My very special guest is Martin Dutre. You can check out his websites, CelticNZ.co.nz and Treaty of Waitangi, that's waitangi.net.nz. We'll be right back after the break in just a few minutes.
Bonkers.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free, and I'm just living my life. There's nothing crazy about me.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the final segment today of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with my miraculous, fabulous, and archaeological extraordinaire in a dark occulted mysticism sense of the word, Martin Dutre from CelticNZ.co.nz and Treaty of Waitangi.net.nz. Martin, do you take donations?
I try and just make it on my own if I can. I don't really advertise for donations myself, so I try and keep my website sort of clean, if you like, and free of all sorts of ads and that, just so that we can just home in on the information. And I've been able to, by robbing Peter and paying Paul for years, I've been able to kind of maintain it. Yeah. Mm.
Well, it's a juggling and balancing act. I found that if you're selling BS, suddenly you've got all the money you could ever want, but you've got no time and no life. But if you're selling the truth, you've got plenty of time and plenty of life, but bugger all money, you know? It's like
there's no money to be made in actually telling the truth. You really just have to take a vow of poverty and get on with it. It's all you can do. You're never going to make a quid out of it.
Yeah. See, I always wanted to just be able to survive, you know, just as long as I'm fed and housed, I'm happy, because I get to expose scumbaggery every day, you know, like that's my drug now.
Yep. No, you're doing a great job. It's really good, but I'll bet you're copying a huge number of insults coming your way.
Not a whole lot. You know, I've become. I practice an ancient Chinese arts with the initials FU, and and the block function is your best friend. If you're talking about stuff that's really unpopular, as I do, somebody comes at you and it's not a constructive criticism. It's not trying to talk to you. It's accusatory. It's in all capital letters. It's ridiculously unfounded. Block! And you suddenly never hear that person again, you know? So they say it to you on Facebook. They say it to you on YouTube. They say it to you on Twitter. They say it to you on Skype. Block! And you allow the toxicity to be purged from your life, much like a teenager might get pleasure out of squeezing an enormous unsightly pimple.
Okay.
That's how we do it. Now, speaking of which, of how we do it, we've only got one more segment, less than 10 minutes left, Martin. I was wondering, well, what is your... Can I ask you, just in terms of going through all of this, you've seen the revision of history, you've seen how you were raised as a boy and that very culture and the general knowledge of the people and everybody getting massively dumbed down. You've seen all these changes. How long did it take you through seeing these changes? At what age did you start saying, man, I really have to do something about this? And what was that? Was there a catalyzing incident?
Right, well, I left New Zealand to do the big OE at the age of 19. I came back, I was 27 or something like that. And, it was just, I just walked into this completely different situation. And, you know, I'd been raised with all those books, A.W. and A.H. Reed books. I think they wrote about 200 books on New Zealand history where all the stuff got mentioned. I talked to many kaumatuas, I'd read many of the oral traditions and things. It was all there. And there was this forced amnesia being put across the top of us. And I couldn't do very much initially. I got married and, you know, you then get very preoccupied with mortgages and trying to just stay afloat and pay for a home and that kind of thing. But then later, I found I did have the time at about the age of 50. Where I could finally address this. I'd been waiting for years for the academics to come in and say, no, all this other new nouveau history is wrong. We're going back to the old stuff. This is the way it really should be. But they never did come in and correct it. So I just went out onto the landscape myself. I used the skills I'd gained as a carpenter using the theodolite and doing surveying work and applied measurement standards and those kinds of scientific standards to what was on the landscape and found there were alignments, solar observatories, it's been quite a journey for about the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And solar observatories and all of these celestial categorizing monuments for people in ancient times, that was all written about and you knew all about this and you just decided to take it from the page into reality, didn't you?
Yeah, right. I mean, technically, we should be celebrating this amazing megalithic history we've got in this country. If you're in Britain, you know, families will go out onto the hills, go and visit some of the old sites, have a picnic and see the beautiful views. And they make pilgrimages to these sites all over Britain and continental Europe. We've got the sites all over New Zealand, and normally they're in beautiful settings, overlooking seascapes, nice and elevated, very, very picturesque. And yet all of the information about it is suppressed. All the archaeologists have got to do is get out of their ivory towers and go out on the landscape and start really looking at what's there. And one way they could really fast-track it is get surveyors from the Otago Surveying School to go and apply their surveying skills to these markers and things on the landscape and get geologists to say, well, that couldn't have occurred there without human intervention. You know, there are all of these scientific, methods that are available to us to prove what these structures are and also their age. Another thing that's, of course, very, very suppressed is the skeletal evidence in the caves of the people who do not have the Polynesian rock and jaw, who've got the very squarish eyes, who've got the very pyramidal nose opening, who've got the small mouth clench, and they're not Maori individuals. They're not of Polynesian extraction. And all of that evidence is suppressed. Whenever the skeletal evidence is brought to light by mistake, somebody excavating or whatever, the skeletons are then whisked away and destroyed. Nothing is allowed to be properly analysed. Unless it, it's not allowed to be analysed unless it upset the status quo and the established way that we look at things.
Mm. And what did your parents do for a living, Martin?
My father worked for the New Zealand Department of Agriculture. He was actually an American serviceman who stayed on. He married a local, and my mother was from Auckland. She went back to the States for just a few years, you know, after the war, and I was born in Los Angeles. But she got very homesick, and my dad had been from a very arid area of Nevada, and he loved the beautiful, lush New Zealand countryside. So he came over here, he finished his education on the GI Bill and joined the New Zealand Department of Agriculture. And used to love travelling around the farms of New Zealand, seeing all that lush territory. Just couldn't believe that you could have two cows to an acre, where in his ranch in Nevada, where he was raised, it took 40 acres to raise one animal. So he loved New Zealand, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I've always said that when people dedicate their lives to the pursuit of truth, and more to the point, the enlightenment of others as to the lost truth, whatever it might be of their particular stripe, they're either born into a family where they're kind of educated in a way in which it becomes inevitable that they'd pick this path. And the other side is when they're particularly talented people who get really, really good grades, essentially, in the establishment structure, and then something real bad happens to them and they spend the rest of their life trying to correct it. Neither of those two apply to you, do they really?
Well, yeah. When I went to school, primary school, I was doing very well. I had some problems at home when I first entered high school. And there for a period of time, I just wasn't interested at all. I was basically going along to school to eat my lunch. Later on, I got another sort of breath of it all and got involved in my education. But found I loved the great outdoors. I loved carpentry work. I didn't like being stuck in classrooms. So I pursued the trades more than any sort of academic fields. And I'm very glad I did. In recent years, I've done a lot of reader writing at the university, the local university. I've spent several years doing that, writing the class notes for disabled students. So I've been right through the system, and I'm really quite appalled at a lot of the kind of history that's taught in those classes, how you only get one half of the truth, especially when it comes to sociology, areas of history, that kind of thing. You'll only get a very, very limited view. You won't get taught the other half. It's very, very important to know. Mm. So I had to bite my lip and keep my mouth shut in a lot of those classes.
Mm. Yeah. I see that same situation now with just police officers. You know that they're wrong, but because they've got a taser, you just bite your lip a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, well, Martin Dutroux, ladies and gentlemen, you can check out his websites, CelticNZ.co.nz and TreatyOfWaitangi.net.nz. Martin, thank you so much for your time today, man. And, keep up the good work, as they say. And I'll try and make sure that these videos are available for people to watch on the YouTube channel. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in. And we'll see you again sometime.